6 years and one day after Germany invaded Poland, the world's second great war finally came to an end. On September 2, 1945, under a hazy Tokyo Bay sky, Japan's surrender was signed aboard the battleship USS Missouri. Cameras clicked, generals saluted, and across continents, millions of families, mothers, wives, children, wept in relief. The war had swallowed nearly everything. By the time the ink dried on that surrender document, between 60 and 80 million people were dead, roughly 3% of the world's population. Entire cities lay in ashes. Dresden, Warsaw, Tokyo. 6 million Jewish people murdered in the Holocaust. Villages erased. Nations starved. It was as if humanity had stared into the mirror and seen its own capacity for destruction and barely looked away in time. Just 7 weeks earlier, the United States had crossed a threshold no one had imagined possible. On July 16, 1945, in a New Mexico desert, the sky itself caught fire. The first atomic test. 3 weeks later, President Harry Truman, new to the presidency after Franklin Roosevelt's death that spring, authorized its use. On August 6th, the Enola Gay, a Boeing B-29 Superfortress bomber, dropped an atomic bomb known as Little Boy over Hiroshima. 80,000 people killed in an instant. Tens of thousands more would die in the following weeks. 3 days later, Nagasaki. Another city, another flash, another 40,000 lives gone. The message was clear. Humanity now held the power to unmake itself. When World War II began, the United States was far from ready for global war. Its army enlisted fewer than 200,000, smaller than Portugal's. Isolationism ran deep, and the Great Depression had left the nation weary of foreign entanglements.
Dear Mr. President, my name is Olaf Olson, 4408 44th Avenue South, Minneapolis, Minnesota. My opinion of present conditions relative to this war is that the low paid wage earner is not getting the break that he should be entitled to, considering the fact that cost of living has been going up. The only ones who have been benefiting by it are those in the middle class and upper classes who have been getting increases in wages to adjust the higher cost of living. It seems that nothing has been done for the people who in the lower brackets who have a very difficult time to make a living for themselves and their families.
But the bombing of Pearl Harbor changed that overnight.
Dear Mr. President, my name is Mrs. M. R. Schuler. My reactions to the war are those of the average wife and mother, for my husband is a defense worker in Newfoundland, and my only son, an engineer employed at the University of Minnesota, is of draft age. Of course, I have read of Pearl Harbor, the magnificent resistance at Manila and Singapore, and so forth. And yet, it has all seemed more like a dream than something real. Yesterday, however, I was shocked into the realization of what it all means by the news of the death of John Martin, the son of a very dear friend of mine. I believe, like most mothers and wives, in peace. In fact, I believe in it so much that I believe in fighting for it. I have never been in favor of starting a fight, but I do believe in finishing it.
Within months, factories were running day and night. The nation became the arsenal of democracy, building planes, ships, tanks, and the largest military force in its history. By 1945, 16 million Americans had served, but nearly half of them were still stationed overseas when the war came to an end. And now the question was, how do you bring 8 million men home? The answer was Operation Magic Carpet, one of the largest logistical efforts in human history. Over 300 cargo ships were converted into troop carriers. Day and night, they crossed the oceans ferrying men back from the front lines. The ships came in droves from the Pacific, the Atlantic, the Mediterranean, docking at ports in San Francisco, New York, Seattle, and New Orleans. Within 14 months, the torrent of deployment that had taken nearly 4 years to send abroad was reversed. They came home to parades, banners, and tears, and a nation that had changed beneath their feet. Factories that once made weapons were shifting to consumer goods. Soldiers dreamed of college, family, and stability. But with millions returning all at once, the country faced an entirely new crisis. Where would they all live? America's next great battle wouldn't be fought overseas. It would be fought on its own soil, in blueprints, zoning maps, and suburban tracts, as the nation set out to build not just homes, but a new version of the American dream. I'm Demetrius Lynch, and this is Built to Divide.
We had to build houses for people to live in. We had to build a water system and a sewer system. We had to set up a police department, put in roads, and erect streetlights so that people could feel secure.
I'll do what I can to help to get them out legally and peacefully. And as far as accepting them socially, if that's what you mean, I could never do that.
Thanks for coming back. In our last episode, we discussed the turmoil that brought forth foundational institutions and events that transformed the U.S., particularly the establishment of the Federal Reserve and the Gilded Age that led up to the Great Depression. We also touched on the New Deal, the birth of the Federal Housing Authority, and the creation of Fannie Mae. If you haven't listened to that episode, I encourage you to go back and listen to all the episodes of this series in order. Today, we trace the fallout from the Gilded Age, Great Depression, and World War II, where the U.S. leveraged wartime production into remaking American society and delivering domestic stability. GI Bill benefits, FHA, VA loans, and a secondary mortgage market powered by Fannie Mae, which drove homeownership from 43% to nearly 62% by 1960. We stepped through the culture that sold the dream, the West Coast's case study houses, and the assembly line suburbia of Levittown. But we also exposed the price, zoning, underwriting, and developer practices that drew bright lines around who could belong, turning stability for many into exclusion for others. And we'll get into all of that after this break. Episode 3, The Great Reset. In 1904, a little-known inventor and writer named Elizabeth Maggie decided to challenge the rules of the American game. She believed the greatest danger to democracy wasn't foreign invasion or moral decay, it was inequality. Watching industrial monopolies swell under men like Rockefeller, Carnegie, and Vanderbilt, Maggie saw how power consolidated not just money, but control over life itself. So she did something radical for her time. She turned that system into a literal game. She called it the landlord's game. Its purpose wasn't entertainment, it was education. Maggie wanted players to feel the squeeze of rent, the thrill of profit, and the despair of collapse. As she wrote in 1903,
"The landlord's game is a practical demonstration of the present system, of land grabbing, with all its usual outcomes and consequences. It might well have been called the game of life, as it contains all the elements of success and failure in the real world."
In other words, a simulation of capitalism's winners and losers. That game would ultimately become Monopoly. And if you've ever played, you've already played her warning. The rules are simple. Accumulate property, charge rent, bankrupt your opponents, and win by eliminating everyone else. The game ends when one person owns everything, or when someone flips the board in frustration. In October 1929, for the United States, the game ended, and it was time to reset the board. When Franklin Delano Roosevelt took office on March 4, 1933, the country was broken. One in four Americans was unemployed. Banks in nearly every state had failed or closed their doors. 2 million people wandered around the country without homes. The Great Depression wasn't just an economic collapse, it was a moral and structural reckoning. Roosevelt, fifth cousin to Theodore Roosevelt, shared his cousin's zeal for reform, but inherited a crisis of unprecedented scale. His first act as president was to call a bank holiday, closing the nation's financial arteries before they bled out entirely. Within days, Congress passed the Emergency Banking Act, and within weeks, confidence flickered back to life. When the banks reopened, deposits flowed in, not out. The first 100 days of Roosevelt's presidency set a legislative pace never seen before or since. What followed became known as the New Deal, a sprawling experiment in national recovery. It put men to work in forests and fields through the Civilian Conservation Corps, rebuilt bridges and dams under the Public Works Administration, and sent electricity across rural America with the Rural Electrification Administration. The programs were partially possible after the marginal tax rate of high-income earners had already reversed under President Hoover, jumping from 25% in 1931 to 63% that following year. Roosevelt also aimed to reform the economy through the National Industrial Recovery Act, or NIRA, which, in collaboration with industry leaders, sought to end cutthroat business practices and suspend antitrust laws in exchange for better wages for workers. However, the Supreme Court ultimately declared the NIRA unconstitutional in 1935. Without the promise of higher wages to fund programs, the highest marginal tax continued to rise, immediately going to 79% in 1936 and peaking at 94% in 1944. Roosevelt wasn't just stimulating the economy, he was redefining the relationship between citizen and state. The government, once a distant referee, was becoming a participant, a builder, a lender, and a safety net. But for all its ambition, the first New Deal was still largely about survival. Relief, not reinvention. By 1935, that wasn't enough. Inequality remained entrenched. Workers were restless, and industry still dictated the rules of play. So Roosevelt went further. The second New Deal wasn't just economic policy, it was philosophical rebellion. It asked a question no American administration had dared to ask before. What if the pursuit of profit alone can't build a stable nation? In this second wave, Roosevelt introduced the Social Security Act, anchoring the idea that a government could guarantee a measure of dignity in old age or hard times. He signed the National Labor Relations Act, giving workers the right to organize and collectively bargain, a direct challenge to the monopolists of industry. The Works Progress Administration hired millions, not just to build roads and bridges, but to paint murals, compose symphonies, and document the American experience itself. Even art became infrastructure. These weren't just programs. They were principles carved into policy. Roosevelt's vision turned the economy from a game of individual winners into a shared project. Imperfect, controversial, but undeniably collective. Not everyone agreed. The same business elite who once backed coups abroad now whispered of plots at home, like the plan known as the business plot. This scheme was a political conspiracy to overthrow President Roosevelt's administration in 1933. A bond salesman for a Wall Street banking firm and a leader of a U.S. veterans organization aimed to recruit and install decorated Major General of the U.S. Marine Corps, Smedley Butler, as a fascist dictator.
I appeared before the Congressional Committee, the highest representation of the American people, under subpoena to tell what I knew of activities which I believe might lead to an attempt to set up a fascist dictatorship. The plan as outlined to me was to form an organization of veterans, to use as a bluff or as a club at least, to intimidate the government and break down our democratic institutions. The upshot of the whole thing was that I was supposed to lead an organization of 500,000 men, which would be able to take over the functions of government. I talked with an investigator for this committee who came to me with a subpoena on Sunday, November 18th. He told me they had unearthed evidence linking my name with several such veteran organizations. As it then seemed to me to be getting serious, I felt it was my duty to tell all I knew of such activities to this committee. My main interest in all this is to preserve our democratic institution. I want to retain the right to vote, the right to speak freely, and the right to write. If we maintain these basic principles, our democracy is safe. No dictatorship can exist with suffrage, freedom of speech, and press.
While historians have questioned the imminent threat of a coup, most agree that the scheme was contemplated and discussed. At the very least, it conveyed the business elite's ire for what Roosevelt was doing. Critics accuse Roosevelt of socialism. The American Liberty League, funded by corporate titans and conservative Democrats, painted him as a traitor to his class. And in a sense, he was. The Second New Deal rebalanced power, not just between rich and poor, but between the private market and public responsibility. For a fleeting moment, the pendulum swung towards the people. Workers organized. Wages rose. Unions gained strength. The federal government became a moral actor, not just a fiscal one. But the temporarily tamed forces were already gathering strength again, preparing to rewrite the rules once more. Sociologist John Dean would later warn in 1945,
"The problem of home ownership will someday be faced squarely by the United States. When that time comes, America will look back on our own time as an era in which society encouraged its families to stride ahead through a field deliberately sown with booby traps."
He was right. The New Deal had restructured the board, but the pieces still belonged to the same players who lay in wait. The machinery of war had become the machinery of finance. Credit, debt, and home ownership would soon fuse into a new national myth: stability through property. The GI Bill, officially the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, became the cornerstone of that vision. It offered veterans education, unemployment support, and most importantly, federally guaranteed home loans. Together with the Federal Housing Administration, or FHA, and the Veterans Administration loan programs, it made long-term, low-interest mortgages possible for millions of returning soldiers. Before the war, buying a home meant putting down half its value and paying it off within a decade, a tall task for most Americans. Now, a veteran could buy a home with almost nothing down and stretch payments over 30 years. It wasn't just generosity, it was policy by design, a way to channel industry power into consumer demand, construction jobs, and civic stability. But that transformation needed financial muscle. In 1938, before the war, Congress had created the Federal National Mortgage Association, or Fannie Mae, to buy mortgages from lenders and free up their capital for more loans. In essence, Fannie Mae turned home debt into a renewable resource, buying, bundling, and reselling mortgages to keep credit flowing. After the war, as VA and FHA loans surged, the model scaled nationwide. By 1948, Fannie Mae was investing in VA loans directly, creating a secondary mortgage market that would eventually define American finance. Combined with tax incentives like the mortgage interest deduction, which allows homeowners to reduce their taxable income, these programs rewired the economy around homeownership. Between 1940 and 1960, Americans had access and a manageable pathway to homeownership, and ownership rates soared from 43% to nearly 62%, the fastest and largest expansion in modern history. With continued messaging around homeownership and an easier on-ramp, owning a home was both a financial advantage and a declaration of identity, proof of good citizenship, stability, and belonging. Politics wrapped it all in purpose. In the Cold War era, where tensions between the Soviet Union, who promoted communism, and the U.S., who championed capitalism, the nuclear family became propaganda. Our prosperity versus their poverty. Imagery in the U.S. linked communism to misery. Pursuit of the American dream was a path to happiness. Homes were transformed into consumption engines. Each room was a stage set for buying. The kitchen wanted the latest mixer, the nursery needed safer plastics, the den demanded a television and matching furniture. Subdivisions multiplied the effect. Rows of nearly identical houses meant your neighbor's upgrade instantly made yours feel behind. Credit followed this script. Department store charge plates, installment plans, and federally backed mortgages stitch retail desire to monthly payments. Home wasn't just shelter, it was a bundle of purchases and proof you belonged. Media, retailers, and developers weren't just selling homes. They sold the American dream. The perfect lawn on TV, the good schools euphemism in classifieds, detergent spots equating whiteness with virtue, every sitcom ending each episode with a spotless living room, and the housewife in print ads smiling through the latest appliance. Proof that the system worked, so long as you fit the picture. Domestic containment casts order as virtue. Dad at work, mom at home, kids in tow. While federal mortgage policy, local real estate practices, and zoning steered who could buy where, the message was simple and relentless. Happiness resided in a single-family home in a homogeneous neighborhood, managed by a cheerful homemaker, paid for by a steady male breadwinner. More ominously, some entertainment and advertisements made light of domestic violence, a wink to an implied hierarchy. Drugs like amphetamines and tranquilizers were promoted and prescribed to women to manage, quote, anxiety and depression, which were marketed as mother's little helpers. Beneath the gloss and flicker of the screen, dissonance grew. Women who'd been Rosie the Riveter were told to grin gracefully and find fulfillment in floor wax. While many continued to find work, the share of women in the workforce dropped approximately 5% from 1945 to 1950. Many at home felt what Betty Friedan referred to in her book, The Feminine Mystique, as the, quote, problem that has no name, a widespread unhappiness experienced by many housewives in the 1950s and 60s. The 1950s had locked in a powerful equation, citizenship as consumption, virtue as domestic order, and homeownership as the ticket to both. Sears, Roebuck & Company had pioneered the trend decades earlier with its modern homes catalogs. Entire houses sold by mail, promising comfort, beauty, and ownership as a sign of success. By the 1940s and 50s, that message was everywhere. Life, better homes and gardens, and newspaper spreads turned housing into aspiration. Bright kitchens, happy children, white fences framing prosperity. While mail-order homes from Sears offered Americans a do-it-yourself version of stability, they were experimenting with a very different vision of domestic life on the opposite coast. Earlier, as the country braced for a massive housing boom, Arts and Architecture magazine announced in its January 1945 issue one of the most radical design experiments in U.S. history, the Case Study House program. The idea was deceptively simple and quietly revolutionary. Under editor John Intenza, the magazine would commission the nation's leading architects to design and build a new kind of American home. Efficient, affordable, modern, and repeatable. Each house would serve as a prototype, a case study in how design and industry could come together to meet the post-war need for mass housing. This wasn't about the mansions or monuments of the wealthy. It was about proving that modernism, the sleek, industrial language of floor-to-ceiling glass, open plans, steel frames, modular components, and lots of natural light, could belong to and even be an improvement for ordinary families. In the program's first issue, Intenza wrote,
"For average prospective house owners, the choice between the hysterics who hope to solve housing problems by magic alone and those who attempt to ride into the future piggyback on the status quo, the situation is confusing and discouraging. Therefore, it occurs to us that the only way in which any of us can find out anything will be to pose specific problems in a specific program on a put-up or shut-up basis. We hope that a fairly good answer will be the result of our efforts."
The magazine itself acted as client, orchestrating a collaboration between architects, manufacturers, and material suppliers to imagine what home could look like in the atomic age. The first group of architects were mid-century modern giants, Richard Neutra, Eero Saarinen, Charles and Ray Eames, Rafael Soriano, J.R. Davidson, and William Worster among them. Together, they envisioned homes that rejected nostalgia and embraced the optimism and anxiety of a new technological world. Southern California became their laboratory. Here, mild weather, open land, and the emerging car culture offered the perfect testing ground for a new domestic ideal. Between 1945 and 1966, the program produced 36 designs, 25 of which were built mostly in the hills and suburbs surrounding Los Angeles. These homes weren't hidden in gated enclaves. They were open to the public, often for weeks at a time, so Americans could walk through and imagine their own futures inside walls of glass. One of the most famous, the Eames House, Case Study House No. 8, captured the spirit of experiment perfectly. Industrial materials reimagined for warmth, play, and family life. Its bright, primary colored panels and modular structure reflected a belief that design could make life not only more efficient, but more human. The case study houses offered a glimpse of what America could have been: open, experimental, egalitarian in spirit. They suggested that beauty and affordability didn't have to be opposites, that progress could serve people, not just profit. However, the case study homes were not adopted en masse, likely for a few reasons. The modern style was very specific and may not have aligned with some preferences. By the end of the 60s, modernism was waning in general, and the prevailing design vernacular of flat roofs, floor-to-ceiling glass, and indoor-outdoor features weren't appropriate for other regions, limiting national adoption. While this architectural optimism flourished in the pages of Arts and Architecture, the market was moving elsewhere. For every case study house visited by a few thousand design enthusiasts, a new development would soon rise to house tens of thousands, not as experiments in living, but as products of a perfected system.
These are the 36 men who built this house. Another day, another 40 houses.
No one understood that system better than William Levitt. Levitt, a New York-born real estate developer and the president of Levitt & Sons, was widely regarded as the father of modern America suburbia. The son of a Brooklyn real estate attorney, Levitt dropped out of New York University to join his father's firm, where he learned to blend business acumen with an instinct for scale. After serving as a Navy lieutenant in the Seabees during World War II, he returned home to confront a national housing shortage for returning veterans. His company took the lessons of wartime production, assembly lines, standard parts, efficient labor, and applied them to suburbia. Levittown wasn't just a development, it was a movement. Row after row of nearly identical traditional wood-framed homes, built fast and cheap, offering returning veterans something their parents never had: ownership.
We had to build houses for people to live in. We had to build a water system and a sewer system. We had to set up a police department, put in roads, and erect streetlights so that people could feel secure.
Levitt's marketing promised that every home was both a sanctuary and a stepping stone, an investment that would grow in value year after year. But this prosperity was built on a system of exclusion. Redlining, racial covenants, and neighborhood stability standards, tools we explored in the last episode, sourced their power in the law itself. At first, American cities were largely unregulated. In the 19th century, land use was a matter of private choice, guided by custom more than government. But as cities industrialized, the push to separate homes from factories, the wholesome from the harmful, gave rise to a new planning language, zoning. The first comprehensive zoning code appeared in New York City in 1916, born out of legitimate public health and safety concerns. It divided land into districts for factories, commerce, and homes, setting height limits and use restrictions. The intent was protection of public health. The result, however, was an instrument of exclusion. Within a generation, cities across the country adopted similar systems. Then came 1926. In Village of Euclid versus Ambler Realty, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld zoning as constitutional, ruling that a city could regulate land use to protect the character of its neighborhoods. Justice George Sutherland, who made up part of the Four Horsemen, a group of conservative justices that often voted to strike down New Deal legislation, wrote that apartment buildings, if placed among single-family homes, could become, quote, parasites, feeding off the open spaces and amenities of their surroundings. That one word, parasite, carried enormous weight. It cast density itself as a threat. It made the detached, single-family home not just a lifestyle choice, but a moral ideal, and everything else as a danger to be repelled and contained. By the mid-20th century, zoning had quietly become the new face of exclusion. Instead of overt racial covenants, which courts struck down after Shelley v. Kramer in 1948, municipalities began using land use laws to achieve the same ends indirectly. Minimum lot sizes, height restrictions, and bans on multifamily housing all worked together to keep certain people and certain incomes out. So, for developers like William Levitt in the idyllic 1950s, he wasn't just selling homes, he was selling an entire social order. His first Levittown, built on Long Island in 1947, offered affordable homes to returning veterans, complete with washing machines, television hookups, and manicured lawns. The price? They were priced around $8,000. The equivalent of roughly $100,000 today. Yeah, imagine buying a home for $100,000 today. These homes were accessible to a very specific profile of working class families that Levitt himself made explicit. When pressed about why Black families were barred from buying homes in his developments, he said, quote, "We can solve a housing problem, or we can try to solve a racial problem, but we cannot combine the two." End quote. In contrast, Eichler & Sons, founded by real estate developer Joseph Eichler, sold homes in their developments to Asian Americans in 1949 and African Americans in 1954. Eichler's salespeople were advised to sell without discrimination. Eichler believed firmly in this principle. He offered to buy back homes from white homeowners that took issue He said he would not employ anyone who opposed non-discriminatory policies, and he even resigned from the National Association of Home Builders in 1958 when the organization refused to support a non-discrimination policy. Ned Eichler explained his father's position on the issues of profit and progress.
I think that builders cannot evade the fact that what they're doing is going to have an impact on the whole community, even on the nation, for a long time, and they cannot simply say, well, I'm just a businessman. I'm here to make a buck.
Eichler and Sons were much smaller in scale compared to Levitt and Sons, who became a transcendent symbol of suburban expansion. Levitt's perspective was the norm, and a chilling, honest summary of mid-century housing policy and the industry's logic. Integration, they claimed, would disrupt property values and threaten neighborhood stability. And since the FHA's underwriting standards and most local banks agreed, exclusion wasn't just tolerated, it was incentivized. Every family that moved into a Levittown home stepped into a carefully curated vision of America. Identical homes, identical lots, identical lawns. A mass-produced dream. Children played in cul-de-sacs where everyone looked the same. Schools and churches were nearby, but public transit and apartments were not. Levitt's efficiency made him rich, but his model made suburbia synonymous with separation, physical, social, and racial. For a decade, Levittown had been sold as a triumph of the American dream, tree-lined streets, tidy lawns, and the quiet hum of stability. But in 1959, that illusion fractured. That year, Bill and Daisy Myers, a young black couple, bought a home in Levittown, Pennsylvania. They'd purchased not directly from Levitt and Sons, but from the Welschlers, a Jewish family that was ready to move on. It was a small legal loophole where William Levitt's contracts barred anyone not of the Caucasian race. He couldn't stop individual homeowners from selling to whoever they chose.
Well, I first read a small article in the newspaper that the first colored family had moved into this community. And following that, why I began to hear on the radio and read in the newspaper that there was some disturbance around this home that these people had bought.
What was your initial reaction?
I was terribly shocked to find that there were people in this community who would be so violently opposed to it. I rather thought that everyone would just accept it as I would.
When word spread that a black family was moving in, the phone at the Welschler's house rang nonstop. One neighbor screamed obscenities on the phone. You loving Jewish mother. The first of many such calls. The Myers were within their rights, but rights in Levittown didn't guarantee welcome.
But there are others who are for the Myers?
Yes, I've read about them.
For what reason, do you think, do they support the Myers?
Frankly, I don't know what reasons they can have for it. If they are homeowners in Levittown, I don't see what reasons they can have for it.
Do you think Myers will be able to live here comfortably?
Comfortably? No.
What course of action are you going to follow?
I'll do what I can to help to get them out legally and peacefully. And as far as accepting them socially, if that's what you mean, I could never do that.
By the time the Myers family arrived, the entire town was watching.
You're aware that a Negro family has moved into Levittown?
Yes, I heard about it.
What was your reaction?
Dynamite. Dynamite.
What have you done about it?
Well, I guess we just discussed it.
How do you feel about the Myers moving in?
Oh, I'm very definitely against it.
Before coming to Levittown, did you have any contact with Negroes?
Well, I came from a small town where we didn't have any colored people. And at that time I had, I had no feelings either way. But while we were waiting for our house to be built, we lived in Trenton for 9 months. And, that was my first contact with them, both in work and going through colored sections to work. and I was very happy I was moving into an all-white community.
Do you think other Negro families will come to Levittown?
Definitely.
Yes.
What do you think will happen?
Well, just what's happening already. I don't know. It's a rumor I read in the paper where they have two colored school teachers now in Levittown. So that's just a good example of what is going to happen.
Well, what's wrong with that?
I do not like it. I have two daughters and two sons. And if there's too many colored people around here, I definitely will get out. I'm not thinking much. Well, I don't want her associating with colored people, period.
Well, I'm very definitely against mixed marriages, and that's eventually what it's going to come to. If children are raised together, they're not going to think of anything of marrying together.
Well, I just could not live beside them. I don't feel that they should be oppressed. But I moved here. One of the main reasons was because it was a white community. And that's the only place I intend to live. If I have to leave Levittown, I will do so.
Do you think a Negro family moving here will affect the community as a whole?
Definitely.
In what way?
I think that, well, the property values will immediately go down if they are allowed to move in here in any number.
A white cross stood planted on the Myers front lawn. Confederate flags fluttered from nearby porches. In Pennsylvania, mind you, not the Deep South. Crowds gathered cheering. Cars flying Confederate flags would drive past, blaring songs like Dixie, the unofficial anthem of the Confederacy. Rocks shattered the Myers windows. Threats of bombs and murder followed. Even the police were attacked. One officer was struck in the head, left bleeding out on the lawn of the family he'd come to protect. Levittown, a model of peace and order, had erupted overnight.
The whole thing centers around the word integration. Well, as Mr. Myers said, because his home has been anything but peaceful since he moved in. He's got three children, and evidently he feels that they will be accepted socially. And I don't feel that they ever will be. But the whole trouble with this integration business is that in the end, it probably will end up with mixing socially. And you will have, well, I think their aim is mixed marriages and becoming equal with the whites. But the only way they're going to do that is by education and by bettering themselves, not by pushing in the way they have here.
Some residents were more open-minded, however limited.
Do you think the Myers will be able to live comfortably in Levittown?
I think so. I hope so. I think the majority of people here will grow accustomed to it and realize that, oh, they can be good neighbors, which I'm sure they are. And I think the majority of people here are not the violent violent group that we have heard so much about.
Do you think the Myers staying in Levittown will affect property values?
I don't think that the Myers have anything to do with the property decreasing or increasing. I think it's purely a white problem, not a Negro problem.
In what way?
I think it is the feeling of the majority group which will influence the property, not the minority group.
In my business, whoever's got money and has good credit or wants to pay cash can buy a car. It has no discrimination, color, religion, or any type of that sort.
Has the coming of the Myers affected your home life?
Personally, my home life, it hasn't affected nothing whatsoever. But on the neighbors, they have a right, because the average white person living in Levittown has 4 and 5 children. Well, let's put it this way. If the Levittown is migrated in hordes of Negroes, which they have a right to come here, but if something that happens that way, pretty soon my neighbor will be having a Negro son-in-law or a daughter-in-law. How would that look?
Wasn't Myers within his rights as a citizen to move wherever he pleased?
Well, let's put it this way. Mr. Myers and all the Negroes have a right. I'm no better than them. They're as good as I am. They can go anywhere they want. I mean, they have a God-given rights, and being a good American, they have the rights to the civil rights, they have the right to pursuit of happiness. But by the same token, we have mixed communities, and it's a proven fact that those mixed communities are over a third empty. He could have stayed there. He had a beautiful home there. The only reason that Mr. Myers came into Levittown is to show people they could get here. It wasn't that he wanted to come to Levittown, but my personal opinion is this. There is something bigger behind this.
Is that your personal opinion only, or is it a fact?
No, I say it's a fact. And I would tell anybody, I mean, barn nobody, I would tell them in a meeting, including the gentleman at this, the head of this committee for bringing Mr. Myers here, I'd tell him.
That was the logic of the system laid bare. Stability and prosperity had been built on scarcity, on the belief that equality would cost you something. Levittown families questioned the motives of the Myers, but it was clear, disinvestment in minority communities. As we've discussed, the cornerstone of this system of prosperity came from the Federal Housing Authority. At its heart, a deceptively technical tool, the Neighborhood Risk Assessment, where wealthy, white, homogeneous suburbs received the highest ratings, and with them, the easiest access to credit. The results rippled across the country. From 1934 to 1962, less than 2% of FHA loans went to black borrowers. Entire cities were starved of investment. As capital drained outward into white suburbs, urban neighborhoods, redlined and abandoned, spiraled into disrepair, prompting those that could afford it to look for a better environment to raise their children. Some economists later argued that the Federal Housing Administration's policies became a self-fulfilling prophecy. By denying loans to, quote, high-risk neighborhoods, most of them black or immigrant communities, the FHA ensured those areas would, in fact, decline. Homes deteriorated because owners couldn't get credit to maintain them. Businesses fled because financing vanished. Poverty deepened, and the data that resulted seemed to validate the maps that created the problem in the first place. And yet, even amid the barriers, black homeownership miraculously rose from about 23% in 1940 to nearly 38% by 1960. On paper, that looked like progress. But numbers don't tell the full story. The geography of opportunity was already fixed. White families bought into appreciating suburbs backed by federally insured loans. Black families were largely confined to undervalued neighborhoods where ownership was little protection against decay. The system had created not only inequality, but a narrative to justify it. It's easy to look back and see Levitt as a symptom, but he was complicit, an advocate, and a benefactor of the system. Levitt was building more than homes. He was actively building physical boundaries. But simultaneously, others were reinforcing these boundaries in the hearts and minds of the public. After the war, as labor grew stronger and civil rights gained traction, business interests recognized a threat. They were losing influence as power shifted toward the people. To counter it, corporate leaders found an effective tool in media. Specifically, they would vigorously cultivate division through media channels. The labor movement had long been the backbone of Roosevelt's New Deal coalition. Unions had fought for wages, benefits, and political voice. But as the economy surged and workers demanded more, a backlash brewed. Big business joined with conservative politicians to weaken unions, and they needed a story the public could believe in, one that reframed solidarity as subversion. That story was fear. Fear of socialism, of outsiders, of the other. Domestically, it played out through racial sentiment. Internationally, through isolationism. This convergence began to take shape in 1953, when Henry Regnery, a conservative publisher and son of a wealthy businessman, gathered a small circle of other businessmen, media figures, and political thinkers in New York City. Regnery told them plainly,
"The side we represent controls most of the wealth in this country. The ideas we believe in are the ones most Americans instinctively believe in too.
But he feared that liberalism, the ideology of government intervention, labor rights, and social welfare, was capturing the cultural high ground, the press, the universities, the foreign policy establishment. He proposed something new, a counterintelligence unit for ideas. Media channels with openly ideological communication in contrast to previous balanced policy-focused outlets. The men in that room already control platforms like Human Events, Regnery Publishing, The Mannion Forum, and the newly emerging National Review. What they built from that meeting would become the blueprint for modern conservative media. Regnery inherited his ideology from his father, William Henry Regnery, a wealthy textile magnate who once supported Roosevelt before turning against the New Deal. William helped found the America First Committee in 1940, a powerful isolationist movement that opposed U.S. entry into World War II, under the banner of patriotism. Like the business plot, the AFC reflected concerns about political and economic changes in the U.S. The AFC's banner of patriotism was complicated by its connection to fascism, too. Charles Lindbergh, the committee's most famous spokesman, infamously blamed, quote, the British, the Jewish, and the Roosevelt administration for dragging America toward war. Later, over 20 sitting members of Congress that were connected to the group were found to have colluded with Nazi agents spreading propaganda in the U.S. This episode, culminating in the largest sedition trial in American history, revealed how easily ideology could blur into extremism when wrapped in the language of otherism. Henry Regnery took a lesson from that. Propaganda works when it feels like patriotism. Using his family's fortune, he built a media ecosystem tailored to a specific audience: white, middle-class, business-minded Americans anxious about losing their place in a changing world. In the 1950s, that demographic was primed to devour that narrative. His network abandoned the pretense of neutrality. News and opinion merged. Outrage became strategy. They didn't just report stories, they manufactured consensus. They warned that liberal media was biased, while creating a conservative mirror image that blurred the line between information and identity. Audiences who consumed it didn't just vote, they belonged. From the beginnings of his father, the Regneries built both the stepping stones for business elites to return to dominance and the platform of support that would cheer them on even at their own expense. Meanwhile, in Washington, the business lobby's political allies moved to dismantle what was left of the New Deal order. President Truman, facing post-war strikes and inflation, saw his popularity collapse as Republicans and conservative Southern Democrats seized control of Congress. They passed the Taft-Hartley Act, curbing union power over his veto. Truman also attempted to expand civil rights with the Fair Deal, which he communicated in an address before the NAACP.
Our immediate task is to remove the last remnants of the barriers which stand between millions of our citizens and their birthright. There is no justifiable reason for discrimination because of ancestry or religion or race or color. We must not tolerate such limitations on the freedom of any of our people and on their enjoyment of basic rights, which every citizen is in a truly democratic society must possess. Every man should have the right to a decent home, the right to an education, the right to adequate medical care, the right to a worthwhile job, the right to an equal share in making the public decisions through the ballot, and the right to a fair trial in a fair court.
The Fair Deal splintered his party. Southern Democrats recoiled at the idea of integration, while business leaders saw federal activism as socialism in disguise. By the late 1950s, corporate interests began to finance media that weaponized patriotism, racial fear, and Cold War anxiety to erode public faith in government intervention. Every call for equality could be cast as radical, every strike as subversion, every civil rights demand as special treatment. Through newspapers, radio, and television, Americans were increasingly conditioned to see government not as a safeguard, but as a threat. And as that narrative spread like a virus, policies that once built the middle class were reframed as dangerous experiments. The purpose? To preserve order, to protect wealth, and to keep the board tilted towards those already winning the game. In 1954, the Federal National Mortgage Association Charter Act quietly transformed the role of federal government in housing. Fannie Mae, once a wholly public institution created to stabilize lending, became a public-private hybrid, exempt from most taxes, but now operating partly with private capital. It was a bureaucratic shift with seismic consequences. Then, in 1968, Fannie Mae completed its metamorphosis, reorganized into a for-profit, shareholder-owned company. It was eventually listed on the New York Stock Exchange, a symbol of how deeply the idea of home had merged with the logic of markets. It still carried the federal halo, but now it spoke the language of Wall Street. Housing, a social good and basic need, officially became a speculative asset. The goal officially was efficiency, to reduce direct government involvement in mortgage finance. But the deeper shift was cultural. With credit now flowing through private hands, risk was no longer something to be managed collectively. It was something to be priced, packaged, and sold. During this transition, another company was redefining what it meant to borrow. On October 1, 1958, American Express, once an express mail service out of Buffalo, New York, launched its first credit card. Demand was so strong that hundreds of thousands of cards were issued within months of its release. Together, the privatization of housing finance and the rise of personal credit rewired the American psyche. The home was no longer just a place to live, it was a lever, a symbol of independence and self-worth, and increasingly a platform for consumption. The formula was elegant and profitable. Fannie Mae bought up mortgages, freeing lenders to make more. Developers built homes to meet that credit supply. And homeowners, now flush with confidence and access to loans, filled those homes with the goods of modern life. Televisions, appliances, cars, furniture. The emblems of arrival. The result was a cultural flywheel. Credit built homes, homes built identity, identity fueled consumption. But the same system that built the suburban dream also dismantled something older, the fabric of interdependence. As ownership became synonymous with success, multi-generational living declined sharply, ultimately reaching its lowest point in 1980, when only about 12% of Americans lived with extended family. The ideal of the nuclear family, a couple, their children, replaced the interwoven households that had once defined communities. That shift may have offered privacy, but it came with isolation. Researchers decades later found evidence of what we lost. In Roseto, Pennsylvania, a small, close-knit Italian-American town, sociologists stumbled onto something extraordinary. In the 1950s, a time when heart attacks were an epidemic across the United States, almost no one under 55 in Roseto died of heart disease. There was no special diet, no remarkable genetics, no modern medicine. In fact, residents smoked heavily and ate diets rich in fat. What kept them healthy wasn't the food, it was each other. Families lived together across generations. Neighbors visited daily, shared meals, and looked after one another. the social bonds were so strong that stress, the silent killer, simply didn't take root. But as younger generations moved out into suburban life, those bonds thinned. By the 1970s, Rosetto's heart attack rates matched the national average. The lesson was clear. Connection mattered. The housing system that grew from the New Deal to the Cold War had promised stability, and for many it delivered. But as the market took over, as Fannie Mae went private, as credit cards spread, as home ownership became a proxy for identity, stability turned inward. The same house that once represented security became a vessel for self-containment. The American dream was no longer about what we built together, it was becoming what we could buy alone. Now, in the housing reform era, the booby traps that John Dean warned of slowly began to reveal themselves. From the Fair Housing Act to HUD's Section 235, from riots to urban renewal, we'll ask, when government finally tried to fix the map, why did so many neighborhoods break? Who paid? Who profited, and what new lines were drawn? Next time on Built to Divide.
A boy last week, who was 16 in San Francisco, told me on television, thank God we got him to talk. Maybe somebody will start to listen. He said, I got no country, I've got no flag. Now he's only 16 years old. And I couldn't say you do.
Thanks for listening. Built to Divide is presented by Lines, my architecture and creative studio. This podcast is produced in collaboration with Gable Media. If you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend and rate and review it on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It really helps others find it. And if you're looking for similar content, Built to Divide is part of the Gable Media Network, where you can find even more like this. Visit GableMedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. And before I go, if you want to see additional photos, video clips, and content that went into this episode, you can visit me at lines.studio/podcasts. Talk soon.
In 1924, Mrs. Coolidge redid the interior and added 18 rooms to the third floor. Her work was necessary, but again the structure was heavily stressed by the haphazard construction. The bill for damages was presented in 1948. President Truman became concerned because the floor of his study was vibrating. An investigation was held, and the structural weaknesses of the White House became immediately apparent. One of the investigators said, "The building is standing up purely from force of habit." The beams under Margaret Truman's sitting room had split. The building was too dangerous for occupancy. The White House was taken apart like a jigsaw puzzle. The pieces were marked and stored away. The whole inside was scooped out. Only the exterior walls were left standing. Steel beams were rigged in the interior. It was a little difficult to get the new steel beams through the windows designed by Mr. Hoban in 1790. It would have been easier and less expensive to demolish the whole building. But the White House is so great a symbol to Americans that the exterior walls were retained.